News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, we're going to be talking with Dr. Jeffrey Sonas about trauma following war and disaster. And Christy, with all of the regional warfare going on around the world, this is such an important topic.
It sure is. And before we get to that, we have some exciting research that matters about sports injuries today. And then we're going to introduce a new segment that we're excited about called Weekend Warriors.
Weekend Warriors. Ooh, I think this is it's different than the Weekend Warriors we're going to be talking to Dr. Sonas about. But
yeah,
it's really important. We are really excited to let our listeners know that we are starting over the next few months to introduce some new feature elements to Your Health that we think are really exciting. Christy and I are very excited about. And the very first one you'll hear in just a few minutes. But first, Christy, we have two research that matters that I think are really important things about injuries. And, you know, so many people around here are doing so many outdoor sports. How can we prevent some injuries? What's your very first one?
The first one is about ice hockey players. And this was a study that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, so a big journal, about the risks of body checking, which is something that's done very commonly in ice hockey.
Yeah, you know, I grew up in Atlanta, and you wouldn't think Atlanta would be a mecca, but I went to all these ice hockey games growing up. And here, since we won the Stanley Cup here in North Carolina a couple years ago with our Hurricanes, there are tons of kids.
Oh.
A lot
yeah.
of my friends' kids are doing ice hockey, and there's this question about, you know, concussions in ice hockey, and so this study is really important.
Yeah, and I've always been impressed watching ice hockey with how rough of a sport it is, and this body checking apparently is allowed in some leagues but not allowed in other leagues. And so this was a study to look at the risk of injury and concussions and whether that differed in young children 11 and 12 years of age, who were in a league with body checking being allowed.
That's in Alberta, Canada.
Compared with those, a league where body checking was not allowed.
And that was in Quebec, Canada. And they looked at 74 teams from Alberta, over 1,000 players, and 76 teams from Quebec, over 1,000 players, and looked at the number of injuries, serious injuries, including concussions and those that were severe. And they've really found really dramatic results from those that did not allow these body checking to occur, much less injuries.
Astonishing. So among these young children playing ice hockey, 11, 12 years old, if you played in a league where body checking was allowed compared with one where body checking was not allowed, it was associated with a threefold increased risk of all game-related injuries. And those are things like concussion, severe injury, and severe concussions, much higher risk.
Right. So I think a bottom line here is if you are playing with your child is playing in any sort of ice hockey league, ensure wherever they are at that this body checking is not allowed. There's no excuse for it from a public health standpoint.
Absolutely.
Well, what's our very next research that matters about injuries?
The next one is about injuries riding a mountain bike. And this is actually in the American Journal of Sports Medicine. And this is about the range of injuries that happen in mountain bikers and, in particular, the range of spinal injuries.
Yeah, you know, they looked at 102 men and 5 women who were seen at a spine center here in British Columbia, again, our colleagues up in Canada, over 12 years with mountain biking accidents, and really looking at these, how serious these were and the rate of these injuries to better understand what factors either led to the injuries or what factors could help prevent these injuries.
And in this case, admissions to the spine trauma center, about 4% of those were related to mountain bike riders. And so this is for all people riding mountain bikes. This is not very common. It's really more common to have wrist fractures or breaking bones in the face or other injuries that are very serious. But the reason they paid attention to spine injuries is because they're so severe with such profound long-term, you know, consequences from those.
Right. 40% of these bad injuries were involved the spinal cord, and of these, more than 40% led to complete paralysis. And so And you know, you can, it's easy to imagine you're doing these mountain bikings and you run off the mountain or you take these large jumps and you just really go down on the spine. And so the bottom line here is helmets didn't help.
They didn't. And I mean, really, they looked at risk of being by yourself or being at the back of the pack. And so I think the take-home message here is to be cautious about tricks or jumps or high jumps. Know where you are and think about riding with other people and staying together.
Yeah, well, and I've got, again, someone who works with me who's a mountain biker. I'm going to have a talk. Speaking of talking, Christy, we really should introduce here. We are so excited to have with us today on Research That Matters, Dr. Ronnie Laney, who is going to introduce a new segment that we have today called The Weekend Warrior. I love this title because it's you know, we all encounter episodes and times where people are out there doing things like taking large mountain bike rides and jumps, and they hurt themselves. And we say, you did what? And so we've invited Dr. Laney to join us as a regular contributor to Your Health to talk about common problems of the muscles and the joints and treatment options in sports medicine, as well as the things that affect all of us who are here just weekend warriors out there doing things maybe we shouldn't be doing.
Absolutely. And Dr. Laney, we're so glad to have you join our team and particularly excited to talk about these musculoskeletal injuries. But first, we want to hear a little bit and share a little bit about you. Of course, Adam and I know you well as a resident in family medicine and someone who's very passionate about sports medicine. But tell us about why you are so passionate about this.
Well, I'll tell you, thank you, Adam and Christy, for having me here. I'm very passionate about it because the Weekend Warriors are great things because I see everybody from 20-year-olds to 80-year-olds who injure themselves doing some common things and not some not so common things, which we will go over.
Well, tell me, give us an example. I mean, you know, we were talking to you about our show and you said, boy, something just happened to a friend that I would love to talk about. Tell us what happened.
Well, the weather's gotten nice out there recently, so I was over a friend's house and he had just gotten a trampoline and some college buddies of his were in for the weekend and they were trying to dunk some basketballs while jumping
off
the trampoline.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
One misstep off the side of the trampoline and he came down wrong.
And landed on his ankle.
Oh, yes.
Oh, my goodness. I'm just seeing that, and I'm just cringing thinking about I'm almost hearing it kind of pop.
Well, there wasn't a pop, but there was some swelling and bruising. And after the laughter died down, we attended to him.
Wow. So what was the result of that?
It was an ankle sprain. A pretty bad one.
Well, so, I mean, a lot of people sprain their ankles. I mean, I've sprained both my ankles twice. The last one was I was jumping off four steps but turning at the same time, stupid that it was, and sprained my ankle. What do you do when someone sprains their ankle?
That's a very good question, Adam. And that kind of depends is the answer. It kind of depends on the degree of the ankle sprain and how bad it is and what the activity that you're returning to.
Let's actually back up a little bit and say, do people really know what is a sprain? When we talk about a sprain or a break, break it down for us.
Very good question. So a sprain involves the ligaments. A sprain is a tear of the ligaments that join from bone to a bone. And a ligament basically is a fibrous material that helps stabilize the joint. And so a sprain happens is when you turn on the foot inappropriately against force and you tear either part of the ligament or the complete tear of the ligament.
And how do you know whether or not you've broken it or not? Because I think this is a big thing. When people like turn their ankle, do I need an x-ray immediately?
That's a very good question. And so, unfortunately, the best way to diagnose a fracture is with an x-ray. So that's why you should have yourself examined by a physician who can tell.
And so what are the general recommendations? You say it depends on how badly they sprained it. But what are the general recommendations you give to people for a sprain?
Certainly. So for most sprains, if they're mild enough, we use something called rice, the rice regimen.
Not the food.
That you eat?
Not the food that you eat. Okay.
Rice is a group of letters that stands for something. So the R stands for rest. You rest for 48 hours.
Like this part.
You ice the injury for up to 48 hours carefully so you don't damage the nerves in the skin.
To cut down on swelling?
And inflammation.
Okay.
C is for compression, as well as to help with control of the swelling in it. And then elevation, E is for elevation, where you elevate the injured part above the level of the heart for the first 48 hours as well. All kind of helps reduce inflammation and edema.
And right. So the compression, the C of that was like an ACE wrap?
That's correct.
Okay, fantastic. Rice.
And I'm sure you're seeing patients here over in sports medicine at UNC Family Medicine, right? And tell us a little bit about, I mean, when folks come in to you all over there, what are they really worried about?
Well, as you alluded to earlier, Adam, they're really worried about did they break their ankle, number one. And then two, how soon can they get back to the activity that they were wanting to do or were doing when they did the injury?
And what do you guys tell them? How soon can they go back?
Well, again, it depends. If they're a competitive athlete, then we usually keep them out a little bit longer. It depends, and they have to go through a lot of physical therapy. But if they're just a normal active adult, then they can usually get back to activity within 1 to 3 days.
Did you tell this guy he could go back to jumping on the trampoline and dunking?
I told him never.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Ronnie Laney, for being with us and joining us for this new segment called Weekend Warriors.
And we can't wait to talk with you again and find out what are people doing out there that maybe they shouldn't be doing, but better yet, after they've done it, what can they do to get better? So thanks for joining us, and we look forward to talking with you again.
Thank you both.
We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Jeffrey Sonnis about trauma following war and disaster. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking about trauma following war and disaster. And certainly with the recent disaster in Haiti and the war in Iraq, we're seeing more up close the effects on survivors on mental health outcomes like post-traumatic stress disorder or depression and others. And this is certainly a timing and important topic today, Adam.
Yeah, you know, Christy, we've been wanting to have on our show really for several months now Dr. Jeffrey Sonnis, who is really an expert in looking at a national, international expert in looking at some of these issues that I don't think a lot of people think about but are yet so critical. So we're really thrilled to welcome Dr. Sonnis, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Social Medicine, Family Medicine at UNC Chapel Hill. Dr. Sonnis completed his medical degree at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, his master's of public health degree here at Chapel Hill, and has a very active research program that looks at how individuals and societies recover from war and conflict and disaster. And he's particularly interested in this connection between mental health and perceptions of justice. Fascinating. Welcome to the show, Dr. Sonnis.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
You know, Dr. Sonnis, reading your work and learning a little bit in preparation today, it really just strikes me how much we in America may not be in tune with what's going on around the world and the injustices that so many people are faced with on a daily basis. And I wonder if you might share with us how this came for you as a real passion and an area of research.
Sure. I participated in a fact-finding mission with Physicians for Human Rights in the early 90s to former Yugoslavia, and I spent a fair amount of time in a refugee camp where people had just come out of the worst concentration camps, and it was one of these life-changing experiences where I came back and I tried to find a way of incorporating that into my own work, into my own research. I vividly remember an experience where we were in a room speaking to survivors, and we spoke to them at first, and they didn't want to speak to us, and we stayed. We talked a little bit more, and one woman spoke up, and she said, "We don't want to talk to you. We have fear into our bones." Mm. And it was hard for us to hear. It was a very emotional experience, but as we talked, they opened up, and when we came back the next day, they thanked us profusely for having come and listened to them, saying it felt good to talk about these things. So it became my passion to say, can we find ways that can kind of help people kind of move forward after having been through horrific experiences like that?
Wow. What a difficult thing. I mean, when you say that, I just felt this little shiver in my bones. The stories that you heard and hear have to be both heart-wrenching and terrifying.
Well, they are, but, you know, some people ask me, they say, isn't this work depressing? And I actually don't think of it that way. I think of it as more, to me, uplifting and hopeful, because we're trying to look at how can people move forward after those kinds of experiences. A lot of people unfortunately end up being stuck in the past. And the kind of work that I'm interested in doing is saying, given that these bad things do happen, how can we help people move forward to try to find ways that they can kind of get unleashed from that lock from the past.
And so in thinking about helping people move forward, I understand there are a lot of things we do for patients who have post-traumatic stress disorder on an individual counseling level. But my understanding is that your research is more looking at what we can do on a population level or a public health level to help people in groups who have survived this sort of injustice move forward.
Right.
Talk to us about that.
Yeah, I think, there's been tremendous amount of research in the last 20 years on post-traumatic stress disorder.
Well, just a quick pause.
Sure.
Tell our listeners what is post-traumatic stress disorder, because we say PTSD. So what is that?
Post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD as it's called, is a psychological psychiatric diagnosis disorder that's very disabling and consists of a variety of symptoms that people experience after having been through an experience in which they where either their own life was threatened or they saw, witnessed someone's life being threatened or loss of bodily integrity. And the symptoms are those of re-experiencing symptoms such as nightmares, arousal symptoms such as rapid heartbeat, and numbing and avoidance symptoms such as avoiding experiences and feeling numb, not feeling anything, not feeling pleasure or pain, just this general numbness.
And it can last for years.
It can last for lifetimes. Okay. Many people will experience it and never get better.
Okay.
But there's been an enormous amount of research, wonderful research in the last 20 years with very good treatments, both medical treatments, medications in the antidepressant family, and psychological treatments, a treatment known as exposure therapy. But when you think about trauma that occurs on a grand scale, war, earthquakes, trauma like that, these individually oriented models just go out the window. I mean, how can you provide individually oriented psychotherapy to millions of people? It just doesn't work.
Well, it sounds like you were essentially, when they came in and thanked you that next day, they thanked you because you were in a therapeutic role. You were listening, but we can't send in 75,000 of you to meet with everyone on an individual basis.
Yeah, the individual models in those post-conflict and grand-scale disasters, they just don't work. I mean, the scale of the trauma is just vastly outstrips the ability of the population to be able to respond to those types of interventions. In Cambodia, for instance, where I have a research project now, in a population of now it's estimated about 11 million people, there are 33 psychiatrists. So, the idea of people going and seeing a psychiatrist, when you talk about the prevalence, how common post-traumatic stress disorder is in these settings, it just doesn't work.
What is the prevalence in that setting? I'm just curious.
Well, in Cambodia, our study is probably the most up-to-date accurate estimate, and we estimated that the prevalence in Cambodia in people over the age of 18 was 11%. Now, that's dramatically lower than previous estimates in refugee populations, but it's about five times higher than the prevalence of post-traumatic stress disorder in the United States. So it's high.
And the people in Cambodia, these are the people who survived this period of genocide and that happened quite a while back that you're studying. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah. And our estimates of 11%, that's 11% of current PTSD, people who have PTSD now. So 11% of the population 18 and over in Cambodia currently have post-traumatic stress disorder.
So it could have been much higher right after all of this happened.
Right. Exactly.
And it also means that if you have – I don't know what the average family size there is, but it may well be that certainly one out of every two families has someone in that family structure who's probably suffering from
this. Absolutely.
Which is astronomical.
Yeah. And so to get back to Christy was asking me a little bit earlier about the types of models that we're looking at. In these countries, a lot of countries that are in post-conflict settings have tried to struggle with this idea, how do we deal with gross violations of the past? And there are two major mechanisms that countries have tried to use. One is trials, a human rights tribunal sponsored by the UN or by their own country to try to find out who were the bad guys and to try these people and then to hold the perpetrators accountable. And the other
as a form of therapy for the survivors?
Well, no,
not just for justice.
As a form of justice. A form of justice of dealing with that gross injustice of the past. And other countries have used a mechanism called truth commissions, in which they try to find out what happened and why. People come forward, but they don't try perpetrators or hold them accountable in a legal sense. And on the there are several people who have said, well, maybe these justice mechanisms can be healing for society. So my interest is in looking at societies that are using either a truth commission model or a tribunal and looking to see whether or not providing justice to people has a beneficial impact on mental health.
Well, those are very provocative questions, and we'll look forward after the break to hearing what you're discovering about the truth commissions and tribunals as a way to work through some of these injustices. We do need to take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Jeffrey Sonas. We'll be right back with UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. And we've been talking with Dr. Jeffrey Sonas, assistant professor of social medicine and family medicine at UNC, about really his really fascinating work looking at the effects of justice and the lack of justice in trauma and really catastrophes in the world, genocide and natural catastrophes. And Dr. Sonas, right before we broke, you really started to talk about these truth tribunals and other ways of really connecting up really therapy for post-traumatic stress disorder with this perceptions of justice. And you had a paper recently in the Journal of the American Medical Association about this as it relates to the Khmer Rouge trials. What did you find?
We found several main findings. Number one, as we mentioned before, the prevalence of post-traumatic stress disorder is about 11% in the population. The second major finding was that desire for revenge was directly associated with post-traumatic stress disorder, and perceptions of justice, people who felt that justice had been done for violations that they or their family had experienced, was inversely associated with post-traumatic stress disorder. And I'll explain what that means. That means people who were high in desire for revenge were more likely to have PTSD, and people who were high in feeling like justice had been done were less likely to have PTSD. And that's, to me, an enormously hopeful finding, because if the Khmer Rouge trials, if the tribunal that's going on in Cambodia right now, if it promotes feelings of justice, then it indeed may be a mechanism by which post-traumatic stress disorder may be decreased. It may be that type of therapeutic intervention if it can decrease the desire for revenge and increase feelings of justice.
And so, again, this is something that is being done on a rural population and population health or more public health approach to make a difference in what could be a lot of people's mental health and suffering for the rest of their lives.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, on the other hand, one of the things we also found that's a potentially worrisome sign is that knowledge of the tribunals was directly associated with post-traumatic stress disorder, which meant that people who knew about the trials were more likely to have PTSD. And 91% of people over the age of 35, that is people who are old enough to have lived through the Khmer Rouge era in the late 70s, were concerned that the trials would bring back painful memories. So we just don't know. We're doing research right now. We have a NIH-sponsored longitudinal study going on right now where we're following people over time to see how they respond to the trials, because we don't know, do these trials make things better by decreasing the desire for revenge, increasing justice, or do they re-traumatize people by making them think about things that had long been buried for good reason? And we just don't know the answer to that.
Well, I think it's fascinating that you're bridging this gap between this population impact that literally is, you know, kills millions of people around the globe over time, and really the individual therapeutic model. And it makes me think, you know, why do we care about this here in Chapel Hill and Durham and Raleigh and North Carolina? You know, what? Because I think there's direct connections between the work you're doing and really mental health care about a whole host of conditions that PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, occurs.
Right. No, I think that's a great point. I think we care about it for a number of reasons. Number one, we are seeing here in North Carolina there are immigrant populations from places where there was substantial conflict. Chapel Hill, for instance, is home to a number of Karen and Burmese refugees who suffered extreme forms of trauma in Burma and en route. Second, and we're just at the beginning of this kind of research, the whole field is, you know, we're looking at it in the context of post-conflict settings, but survivors of violence of all types really crave justice. You know, survivors of domestic violence, survivors of child abuse, victims of assault, you know, they often don't conceptualize their experience in mental health terms. What they want is justice. And one of the things that I think we need to do in this research is to find out, well, what does justice mean to them? And by providing justice to them, can we in fact help them move forward? Can we in fact help decrease the depression and post-traumatic stress disorder that often follows in the wake of those types of experiences? And we just don't know. We're just at the beginning of that type of research.
And so the idea is if that can work on a population level, then can that transition back right. to the individual level here in America?
Exactly.
I mean, I know there's this book out now about the I forget, it wasn't the Truth Commission, but the Innocence Project here in North Carolina. And one of the very first cases about someone who was behind bars, falsely accused actually in this case of rape. But for him, justice was not just the Innocence Commission saying he was not guilty and getting out of prison and getting money, but it came from the person who accused him in this case falsely being willing 2 years later after he's out of jail to meet and apologize. And that, it sounds like, brought a sense of justice, which also then probably had some healing potential.
Well, I think you're touching on great points. I mean, I think the kind of work we've done, I've done work in South Africa with Bosnian refugees, now in Cambodia. And what we've discovered in all of these settings is that while many people equate justice with punishment, to survivors, justice is much more than that. They want punishment of perpetrators, but they also want apology from the perpetrators. They want financial restitution. They want to understand why did it happen, how did it happen, and why. So there's a whole variety of things that are bound up with people's sense of justice. And I think unless we give them all of those things, then I think people aren't going to have that feeling of being satisfied.
Well, I think it'll be interesting as you do further research to also try to understand how that differs among different cultures. Are those the same definitions of feeling like justice was done, or does that differ in America or based on our own cultural backgrounds? Or is that a fundamental part of being a human?
Well, you know, it's a great question. And I'll tell you what my hunch is right now. I honestly think there's something universal about that. We developed this instrument to measure psychological scale to measure perceptions of justice in South Africa, and we are testing it in the field. And I attended a talk by a woman who's a very famous nun in Seattle who runs a program for domestic violence survivors. She gave a talk entitled "No Healing Without Justice." And she listed all the things, the elements that are justice for survivors of domestic violence. And it was exactly the same as what we had discovered in South Africa.
Wow.
I mean, you know, I think obviously there needs to be more research. But I do think there's something fundamentally human about what survivors want after having been through an experience of violence or injustice.
When it sounds like at some levels that ultimately this moves us from a sense of justice to a sense of forgiveness or at least acceptance. And then now you're at the interplay of culture and religion mm-hmm. and what you're bringing to this, Dr. Sonitz, which is public health. And my question is, then are there some implications at a population level for certain strategies that might be utilized to help bridge these different fields here to help promote justice? Would there be roles for what we might do to disseminate information about the outcomes of these, for instance, tribunals?
Right, right. Yeah. Well, I think the way the field needs to move forward is to be broader in conceptualizing what outcomes you're looking for. I think, unfortunately, mental health has been stuck in looking at the only thing that can happen after trauma is post-traumatic stress disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you don't think about issues like justice or reconciliation or forgiveness or any of those kind of bigger things, I think you're ultimately not going to give people what they need or want. I think post-traumatic stress disorder is important. It's a disabling disorder, but it's not all there is. And so you need to think about those bigger things, or people aren't going to feel like they got what they needed.
Well, this is certainly important research that you're doing that can really have a global impact. And we thank you for sharing that with us today.
And hope that you'll actually come back another time. I mean, we haven't even scratched the surface, not even barely scratched the surface here. And there's so much happening in the world today. And the lens you've given us is an important one. Thank you.
Well, thanks for having me.
We've been talking with Dr. Jeffrey Sonas of the UNC Departments of Family Medicine and Social Medicine about trauma following war and disaster. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health. For the House Calls segment of our show today, we are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions, your health experiences, and your attitudes towards medical care.
And tell us about your own experiences and questions, and we will address them on an upcoming show. You can send them to yourhealth@unc.edu, or you can call us at 966-8081. And we'd like to ask our guest executive producer, Carol Ripley Moffitt. Welcome back, Carol.
Thank you.
To read our House Call number one today.
All right. From patient number one, I have a difficult medical condition. I'm in my 40s and started experiencing numbness in my leg 9 months ago. So I saw my physician who determined it was not a pinched nerve. But a few months later, I began experiencing continuous pins and needles all over my body. Not painful, but certainly a distraction. I had some blood work and was diagnosed with diabetes, which I controlled with diet and exercise. I even lost 30 pounds in the process. My physician says the condition is still related to diabetes, but I have some concerns for multiple sclerosis. When I asked my physician for an MRI, she was hesitant because she said that my symptoms just don't add up. I'm finding the constant tingling sensation to be stress-inducing, and I would like to receive a more thorough diagnosis. Do you have any ideas or advice?
Wow, what a great question.
It's a great question. It sounds like a really difficult situation for you, something that's really bothering you with this pins and needles feeling all over your body and where you don't really feel satisfied with the answer.
Yeah, and you know, what you have, we would most likely call a neuropathy, which is really just a term for painful nerves. But the causes of that type of condition are really very, very large. And diabetes can be one of the causes, but it's a little bit unusual that you got the neuropathy with diabetes that's controlled just with your diet and exercise. And so I don't know. What do you think, Christy?
Well, I think it's also unusual that it's over your whole body and not – usually with neuropathy from diabetes, it's
think it's just
your
like
feet
the toes or the fingers.
Hands. Yeah.
I'm kind of with you on this one. I'm with our listener here. I would search for an answer. I wouldn't be fully satisfied that maybe this is the answer, but I would want to be working with your primary care physician and a neurologist here.
Yeah, and I would go back to your primary care doctor and say, listen, I don't feel satisfied and this is making me worry. And so together you can come up with a plan to investigate more thoroughly.
On the other hand, it doesn't sound like multiple sclerosis.
No.
Not the way it presents. Don't have too many concerns about that, really. What's our very next house call, Carol?
Okay, this is from a 60-year-old woman who says she's very active and healthy, has been all of her life, but on 4 or 5 occasions during the last few months, while she's been doing nothing, out of the blue, she says, I feel a little lightheaded and spacey. I'm not dizzy. I do not feel like I'm going to pass out, but I do feel foggy and even forgetful for a few moments. My neurologist has done some tests and has ruled out seizure and stroke, and says that I'm not in any immediate danger. A friend of mine suggested that I see a cardiologist and get a second opinion. Even if it's not dangerous, it is very scary. Thanks for your thoughts.
Gosh, that does sound scary. I mean, just the feeling of having that lightheadedness come over you like that and not having an answer would be scary.
Yeah, and I suspect when you say even though it's not dangerous, it's scary, that you may be repeating something that someone has told you, and yet it is still scary for you, and that's why we're getting this question here. And boy, talk about things that you worry about. And here, you know, we're talking about a neurologist again, and now a second opinion maybe from a cardiologist. which I think is a good idea.
I think it's a good idea, too. But again, I have to keep coming back to the primary care doctor who's really can take that thorough history and find out, think about multiple organs and different parts of you that could lead to that sort of thing. So I would say talk to your primary care doctor and maybe
because you need a quarterback here to help because this may take a while. This may not be an easy answer, and you need to keep taking – you know, I had a doctor, Christy, in medical school said if – you know, to make a diagnosis, you first take a history. If you're still in doubt, you do a physical exam. And then if you're still in doubt, you go back and take more history.
Right.
And that's
before
what you may
– run more tests.
And that's what you may need to do here.
Sure.
So good luck with this. Mm-hmm. We're supporting you.
What do we have next, Carol?
My husband went to the doctor for a regular checkup and informed the nurse that he occasionally takes a puff from an inhaler that was prescribed several years ago. He only uses it a few times a year when he feels like he wheezes. He doesn't smoke or have a history of breathing problems, but feels more comfortable having the inhaler around as it does open up his lungs in those rare times that he feels wheezy. After talking to his doctor, he was prescribed a new inhaler as well as another medicine, Advair Diskus, which he tried once but did not like. What do you think about this? Does he really need both medicines?
Well, that's thank you for sharing, and thank you for advocating for your husband to try to get some of the answers that it sounds like maybe he didn't get from that visit. It sounds like you're probably talking about two different medicines, one being albuterol, which is more of a rescue medicine, and this other new medicine, Advair.
Which is this combination of a long-acting albuterol-type medication with a steroid, which is not really designed to be used as a rescue medication because it has this long-acting medicine to dilate your lungs. And so when you're having just a short problem, you really want that short-acting albuterol. So there's some patient education here that we really need to work with to understand if you really even need that Advair.
And I would encourage you and your husband together to go back to the doctor and say, okay, what are these two medicines? What are they for? I mean, the Advair is not – it's supposed to be a daily medicine, so it's not a once a time did it make him feel good. And go back and say, what are these for? Why does he need both? And go from there.
Yeah, and one last little point here. Don't use the same medicine that's several years old.
That's true.
We know that's a problem.
Expired.
You know it's a problem. Let's just get rid of that and let's move on.
Absolutely.
What's our very last house call, Carol?
Recently, I lost my father because of a blood clot. After a long bout of pneumonia in the hospital, I thought that he would be better off at home than at the hospital, so I took him home. He died the very next day. I know it's not my fault because he had been ill. But it happened so suddenly, and I am struggling not to feel guilty. I'm not religious, so I don't have a minister to talk to. Any advice?
Wow.
Thank you for sharing that.
Wow.
It's a really, really difficult situation.
And you're not alone.
Of it. Yeah.
You're not alone because, first off, a lot of people have had situations like this. And so by you sharing, you really are helping others. So thank you for sharing.
And what we don't know is whether or not he would have passed away in the hospital that day or whether or not being at home, mattered. And if he did pass away, would he want to be in his own home and his own surrounding to do that? So there are a lot of questions that it sounds like you're left with and that we can't answer.
And he probably did get the blood clot while he was hospitalized for the pneumonia. There's a lot of research that says these things happen frequently in a hospital. They are a frequent cause of death. And but the guilt is that, he did die, and it sounds like that you've had a, really strong relationship there. And so what kind of advice, Christy, can we give?
Well, I'd say having someone to talk to is important. And it's not something we can do well over the air, but having some counseling, some grief counseling.
Your primary care physician should be trained and have some abilities to listen and talk with you.
Or even talking to your father's doctor about what happened and can you explain it and would it have been any different?
And then oftentimes there's also, while we do encourage people to talk with their spiritual advisors, ministers, priests, rabbis, and others, there are programs like UNC Hospital has a bereavement program, and they'll run classes, but every 6 weeks they'll have groups, and you can share your story and listen to other people's stories, and that is very healing for a lot of people.
Thank you for sharing your story, and we wish you the best in your grieving process.
Well, I think that's going to conclude our house calls today, Christy, but it's nice that we've been able to talk a little bit about sharing grieving processes and
talking about asthma medications or medicines for wheezing.
Ways of understanding that what may be multiple sclerosis, but other ways of getting second opinions from others.
And the feeling lightheaded and different ways to investigate that more fully. So thank you for your questions, and thank you for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you and your health. Please share your health-related questions by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu or calling us at 919-966-8081. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, and you can also follow us on Twitter.
And we'd like to thank the staff at WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our great guest producer, Carol Ripley Moffitt, our guest today, Dr. Jeffrey Sonas, and we already thanked again our new regular feature, Dr. Ronnie Laney. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of the UNC Department of Family Medicine, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we'll talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.